It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll talk about how bias in the technology industry finds its way into the products we use every day.
First, there's bipartisan support for a bill that would allow hemp farming here in Wisconsin. Republican lawmakers and farm groups made the case in a public hearing today on the proposed legislation.
Hemp has been confused for marijuana because it's also a form of cannabis, but hemp doesn't have the mind-altering properties that marijuana does. It can be used to make various products, like clothes, rope, food, and plastics.
Todd Richmond is a reporter for the Associated Press. He was at the hearing today. He joins us now. Todd, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, what case are lawmakers making here for letting farmers grow industrial hemp in Wisconsin?
Well, Representative Jesse Kramer and Senator Patrick Tustin are the lead authors of the bill, and their argument is that it's twofold. One, they argue that it gives farmers an opportunity to raise another crop that could be profitable, opening up more doors for them, giving them more opportunities. Their second argument is that hemp is used in a wide range of products, batteries, clothing, even flak jackets and building materials. And so they feel that there's a wide use for this product. And in fact, in World War II, it was widely used during the war effort.
As I understand it, Wisconsin was big in hemp back in the day. Is that right?
The state was one of the leading producers of hemp, especially during World War II, when Wisconsin produced 3/4 of the hemp grown in the United States during the war effort. But then demand plummeted, and China seize control of the market, and it's essentially illegal right now had been illegal until the 2014 Farm Bill.
Right. It had been a federal law made it basically impossible to grow this. Are other states already, now that they can, already tackling this and letting their farmers grow hemp?
Yeah, the 2014 Farm Bill authorized states to run hemp cultivation research programs. So that has opened the door for a number of states to begin legalizing hemp cultivation. Right now, there's at least 30 states, according to the National Conference of State Legislatures, that grow or cultivate hemp in some capacity, including Wisconsin's neighbors, Minnesota, Michigan, and Illinois.
Part of the reason, of course, it's been illegal to grow hemp is that it's related to marijuana, but hemp does not equal marijuana, advocates for hemp are saying. What is the difference?
Basically, it's the amount of THC in the two strains of plant. Marijuana and hemp, I guess you could think of them as sort of cousins, but hemp contains a much lower level of THC that is not enough to produce a high like the marijuana plant can.
And one concern I've seen out there is that, okay, maybe people are growing hemp legally, but they might conceal illegal marijuana production on the same farm. Is that a concern?
Well, yeah, Jesse Kramer was asked that question this morning at a news conference about people trying to hide full-fledged marijuana plants within their hemp crop. And his response was that a hemp plant cross-pollinates so strongly that it would pollinate the neighboring marijuana plants and then dilute the THC in those plants so that the street value of the drug at that point would be greatly reduced. And there's always the possibility that someone could hide a marijuana plant within a corn crop or a soybean crop, potentially, or within other crops. So that was Jesse Kramer's response.
Talking to Todd Richmond from AP, looking at a proposal to legalize the growing of industrial hemp here in Wisconsin. And Todd, this would make it legal for farmers to do. Do farmers actually want it? What are we hearing from the farm groups in the state?
Well, nobody's registered against the bill. The Wisconsin Farm Bureau Federation and the Wisconsin Farmers Union have both registered in support. And the Farm Bureau President, Jim Holte, was at the news conference today that Jesse Kramer and Patrick Tustin held to promote the bill. So they're making a big push for this, and farmers, this bill would not just open the door wide open to hemp production. farmers would need to obtain a license from the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection and pay a fee for that license. So it would be regulated tightly by DACAP, would be the gatekeeper on who could actually grow and who couldn't. Anyone with drug convictions would not be allowed to grow hemp.
Is there a sense that this would be an economic difference maker for Wisconsin, at least according to supporters of the legislation?
Supporters of the legislation claim it will be. Ken Anderson, who runs Hemp Legacy out of Prescott, he produces seeds for use in other states, had said that you could generate as much as $900 an acre, according to him.
And you say nobody's registered in opposition to this at this point?
That's correct.
Where is this legislation now in the process?
It got a public hearing today in front of the Senate Agriculture Committee, and that is the first movement we've seen in the legislature on the measure, which was first circulated for sponsorship back in February. So this has not been a real high priority for a legislature that's been more consumed with finishing the state budget and passing the Foxconn Technology Group incentives package for their plants in southeastern Wisconsin. Now that they're clear of this, other bills are starting to surface, and we're seeing movement. This is one of them. So the next step for the Senate Agricultural Committee would be an executive session to approve the bill. That would clear the way for a full Senate vote.
Is there bipartisan support?
There are a number of Democratic sponsors attached to the bill, including Lena Taylor of Milwaukee, Chris Larson of Milwaukee, Melissa Sargent from Madison. So, yeah, there's a number of Republicans and Democrats that are together on this bill.
Todd, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Very good. Thank you.
Todd Richmond's a reporter for the Associated Press. He joined us to look at a public hearing held today looking at a bill that would allow Wisconsin farmers to grow industrial hemp.
Coming up, technology creators don't always reflect the audiences that use their products. We'll talk with our guests about how bias creeps into technology and find out how it affects us and our society. Stay with us here on Central Time.
For many, technology is part of everyday life. You might check your phone first thing in the morning and right before you go to bed. You could track your diet on an app, post on Facebook, and maybe even adjust your thermostat at home while you're still at work.
But not all technology is helpful, and sometimes it commits some pretty big blunders. And our guest says that can alienate users, perpetuate stereotypes, and affect decisions on hiring and criminal sentencing.
Sarah Wachter-Betcher is the author of the new book, Technically Wrong, Sexist Apps, Biased Algorithms, and Other Threats of Toxic Tech. Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I think a lot of us look at a piece of technology or a program or something, and part of our brains thinks, well, that's objective. That's not, that doesn't have any human input in it. We can trust it. And that's part of reading your book. That's part of where we go wrong, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think it's normal that so many of us do that because I think, you know, that's kind of the image that technology has projected to us for a lot of years, that it is neutral and unbiased. But the reality is it's all made by people, and people have biases. All of us do. And so those things can make their way right into tech products.
And you've been in the industry yourself, and you write that you started paying attention to how products are designed, and you notice that they're often full of, quoting here, blind spots, biases, and outright ethical blunders. Can you give us some examples of what you started to run across?
Yeah, absolutely. So it started happening a few years ago where I had started noticing in my own life that, you know, I couldn't use certain forms online, that they wouldn't accept my name because it's too long and has a hyphen and whatever. And those are just kind of petty little things that would be really frustrating, though, where I would be, you know, getting these error messages that my name was rejected. But then I also noticed all these other examples. They just started kind of creeping in, where there were systems that were asking for too much information, where they were demanding too much, you know, data about your gender and about your background and about your identity. And then one day, a really tragic thing happened to my friend Eric Meyer that we actually made us start talking to each other and write a book for people in our industry, which was he went onto Facebook to kind of see what was going on. It was Christmas time. He wanted to get a sense of, you know, all of the different photos of his friends and family opening presents and whatnot. And what he got instead was this really, really painful reminder, which is Facebook had been promoting its thing called Year in Review, which was these little albums that they would put onto your profile saying, like, here's your highlights from the year. And they wanted you to share them with people. So they would take your most popular content that you posted all year and kind of repackage it up for you. And the most popular thing he had posted that year wasn't something he wanted to be reminded of and had never asked for. It was a photo of his daughter, Rebecca, who had actually died on her sixth birthday that year of aggressive brain cancer. And so that Facebook, you know, put that back in front of him. And not only that, but surrounded it by their own graphics of like people dancing at a party and balloons and streamers and said, hey, Eric, here's what your year looked like. And he was just heartbroken by it. So that was an example of a tech company sort of taking his content and putting it out of context and inserting it into this place that he'd never agreed to, didn't want, and that was really hurtful. And from there, I just started talking to people about this and asking questions and poking around. And suddenly I was flooded with examples of bias or lack of foresight being built into tech products and that affecting everything from, you know, like little design decisions in a Snapchat filter that ends up with, you know, an Asian stereotype filter that is really offensive when it's supposed to be a filter that makes you look like you're in an anime, to bias and algorithms that are being used in software to decide how long somebody's criminal sentence should be.
And a big, that's a great example, a horrible example, but a really good example of what you talk about in the book. Nobody at Facebook said, let's find this parent whose child died and rub their face in that. They have this algorithm that they've programmed to do a thing, to pull out information from that user and show it to them, and then they step back and let it rip. And this causes trouble, not just in that way, in a lot of ways, right?
Absolutely. And I think that more and more of our technology is being algorithmically driven because that's how you can deal with this huge amount of data, right? Like nobody at Facebook is going to sit down and think about your and my highlights of the year individually. You have to do that programmatically. But when you do that, you take on risks. And the way that they did that, you know, had a lot of flaws in it. And nobody meant for this to happen. There's a lot of really great people who work at Facebook. I actually know a woman who was on the team that launched that product, and it broke her heart when she saw this story. I mean, she did not want this to happen, but it is definitely what happens more and more. And sometimes in really scary ways when we are not training people in the technology industry to think about the, you know, social or emotional or political impact of the work that they're doing. And we're not kind of bringing in a more diverse set of voices into the technology and design process.
Let's talk about that diverse set of voices. There have been controversies in Silicon Valley over diversifying technology companies and then push back from people within the technology industry sometimes. You make the case that it's not just diversity from its own sake, that design failures happen when you don't have a diverse group of people, of engineers and designers at the helm. How does that happen?
Yeah, well, I would say that that happens in a number of ways. The first thing that I think is really important is that we all have blind spots. I mean, are you familiar with any of the inattentional blindness studies where they have people watch a video of basketball players passing a ball around and then tell them to count the number of times, you know, the people in the white shirt pass the ball? And halfway through the video, they have somebody in a gorilla suit jump onto the video and beat their chest and then walk off screen. And every single time they do this experiment, it's been done so many times, 50% of the people who watch that, they don't see the gorilla. Brains are really bad at seeing details that they're not expecting. And in the tech industry, if you have a really narrow group of people that's designing products and they only have the perspective and experience that they have, and they're not actively being trained to look beyond that, they're simply going to miss out on a lot. So having more diverse people in the room will absolutely make a difference if those people are empowered to actually speak up and are able to get into positions of authority where they actually have the ability to steer the direction of the products and to say something if they see something come by that is problematic.
You share the story of a company that was trying to design a watch, like a competitor to an Apple Watch sort of arrangement, but one targeted at women. Can you tell that story? Because it went haywire. It ultimately never came to market.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it did in a way and not in a good way. So that is a story about a woman I spoke with who is a, you know, Middle Eastern American designer, and she was working in Silicon Valley at this innovation center. So an innovation center in Silicon Valley typically means like a big corporation will create this kind of small hub there where they're doing the interesting and exciting new stuff. So, you know, like a lot of car companies have them, et cetera. But this was one for a company that was doing more, you know, communications technology. And in her role there, she was going to lead design research. So actually talking to people and figuring out what it was they were going to design for this product that was going to target women as a smartwatch. And so they wanted it to be something that would be kind of that like mid-market Macy's level design, you know, and they wanted it to be something that women would find fashionable and want to wear. So she goes into the first meeting and there's simply no other women in the room. It's just her. And she's like, okay, well, that's okay. You know, here we are. And as soon as she's in there, everybody in the room is talking over her and saying like, well, you know, my wife says this and my wife says that. And she's sitting there going, what if we did real research though, like talk to some actual women, instead of just trying to extrapolate from the, you know, like the wives of the people in the room. And she just couldn't really get a word in edgewise. So it was just such an insistence that they already understood the quote unquote female market. And so when she went out and did her research, she found some really interesting things. So one of the things that she had found that was very clear in the research was that a primary use case for this smartwatch was that women said they needed to be able to kind of like quietly stay on top of stuff while they were in a meeting. So for example, if they had kids, they wanted to be able to know if they ever got a message that, you know, there was a problem at daycare. And they wanted to be able to keep track of that kind of stuff and never be inaccessible, but they didn't want it to be obvious. They didn't want to be looking at their phones. And she was really taking note of these kinds of insights, right? When she brings them back to the group, they're just unable to listen to them. Just like, no, 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 women want this stuff for leisure time. It's just for exercise and shopping. And they just couldn't hear her. Eventually, the project really stalled. They just didn't have any direction for it. So they brought in a celebrity to help market this thing. And the product entirely flopped. It wasn't based off of what people actually needed. It was just based off of some stereotypes about what women are looking for. And, you know, that's one example, but I've heard like 1,000 stories like that, because as soon as you start asking people who work in Silicon Valley, they just come out of the woodwork. Like women just keep coming to me and telling me very similar stories.
We're talking to Sarah Wachter-Betcher. She's the author of the new book, Technically Wrong, Sexist Apps, Biased Algorithms, and Other Threats of Toxic Tech. One high stakes thing that can go wrong, those biased algorithms in the title of your book, used in everything from hiring decisions to sometimes criminal sentencing. Can you talk about the sort of garbage in, garbage out that can really create problems for people in algorithms?
Absolutely. So one example that I talk about in the book came out of an investigation that ProPublica did last year on software called Compass, which is used in criminal sentencing. And what Compass does is it assigns a risk score for recidivism. And what ProPublica found in their evaluation was that it was systematically giving Black defendants higher scores than white defendants, even when they had similar criminal backgrounds. And the underlying problem is really in how they're deciding what risk means and where that data is coming from. So effectively what you end up doing when you create an algorithm like that is you have to feed the algorithm a lot of historical information about things like people with criminal backgrounds. Well, if you happen to believe, like I do, that in the past we've had racist policies around policing and we've had higher rates of incarceration for Black people that are unfair, and you're using that data as the basis to form your future predictions, then you're not going to stop that problem. You're actually just going to recreate that problem, but you're going to hand the keys over to the machine. So instead of a human person having to make the decision, like a judge, it's just like, oh, well, the machine said this person was high risk. So it just sort of reduces the responsibility of the person, but it doesn't necessarily reduce the bias whatsoever.
And then I want to look at social media, Twitter and Facebook. You write about, you know, obviously these things have been successful products. A lot of people use them, and a lot of people have found that they're really great for hate mobs, hate speech, interfering in elections, that sort of thing. And you, again, see at the core here a design problem in the way social media is set up and maintained. How could we do that better?
Yeah, well, I think that social media is obviously very powerful, and I'm a big fan of it. I use it. I'm not trying to tell people they shouldn't be using it or that it hasn't brought a lot of good into my life. However, I think that if you look at something like Twitter, that's a product that at its core was designed around this concept of an update. So, you know, you kind of can send these short little messages out into the void. Originally, like the way it was conceived of was really to be similar to how, you know, delivery drivers and bike messengers would send out little updates about their location over CB radios. Like that was sort of the concept that launched Twitter originally. And because that was its kind of original core idea, it took them a really long time to recognize that people were using it to abuse other people in sort of mass coordinated attacks. And I would argue that it took them way too long to recognize that and to start to do anything about it. It was really only last summer when Leslie Jones, who was the one of the actors in the new Ghostbusters, when she was being attacked with a ton of racist, vile threats and rape threats, it was really only after that had happened that they kind of started paying attention and saying, yeah, we're going to do something about this. But here we are a year later, and most of those features really haven't been implemented. So I think it's a matter of a lot of misplaced priorities where people put it off for a very long time and now are facing some dire consequences.
Sarah, briefly, as we wrap up, you've been making this argument in this book and elsewhere. Are people starting to listen, do you think?
I think they are. I think 2017 is almost a little bit of a turning point because it's been a weird year. And we are now seeing, for example, Facebook coming under fire from federal investigators for allowing, you know, Russian-backed organizations to buy up all these ads during the election last year. Like, that's really just starting to get uncovered. I think that this year, people are starting to push back against technology in ways that they haven't in the past, and because they've realized the risks that are involved. And I'm really excited about that because I think that we're going to have a lot better conversations about technology the more that we push back against its overreach and stop assuming that it's necessarily right.
Sarah, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
That's Sarah Wachter-Betcher. Her new book is Technically Wrong, Sexist Apps, Biased Algorithms, and Other Threats of Toxic Tech.
Coming up after the news, we'll get book recommendations for fall reading season here on Central Time.
The weather is getting chillier, and that means we're getting close to ideal reading season. There's not much cozier than curling up with a good book in the fall. Luckily, fall is also a big publishing season when lots of new titles get released. And we want to hear what you're reading now, what you're looking forward to digging into. You can call in with your reading list at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We were talking about this a little bit yesterday. I've got a pretty good reading list going. Mary Beard, SPQR. I think I said her name wrong yesterday. Mm-hmm. And now I've just finished that, and I'm turning to some fiction now. What's on your reading stack?
Right. Well, I'm still working my way through a couple library books I waited long and patiently for. I was so excited when they came in. One is the new Sherman Alexie book. It's a memoir about his troubled relationship with his mother. I love his writing so much. And this is a really, really personal take. And it mixes the memoir with the poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just beautiful and really difficult, but really beautiful and kind of a searing read. So I love reading that. And I'm also reading a novel right now. It's kind of fun. It's maybe the opposite. It's a really fun read called The People We Hate at the Wedding, about kind of a dysfunctional family.
And I've got a couple fiction, kind of, you know, I like science fiction, fantasy genre. Ken Liu, The Grace of Kings was the first one. The sequel is just out. So that's what I'm reading now. And then just from the library, N.K. Jemisin, her trilogy that started with The Fifth Season. Hmm. That one just came out.
What is that one?
N.K. Jemisin. She's a science fiction and fantasy author. And it's this sort of post-apocalyptic landscape sort of thing. I love the first two books. They're a little bleak, I'll warn you, but really good, really interesting characters. Comes together really interesting. So my wife has first dibs on reading the third one in the trilogy. Well, I read the Ken Liu one, and then I think we'll trade off after that. So it's a great reading season so far.
Right, and we've also been thinking about what do we want to reread? This is a great season to reread books. There's a book that I love, and it's called I Don't Know How She Does It by a British author named Alison Pearson. And I just found out there's a sequel out. I don't know how I missed that. But that one is out. So I might actually cough up the money and buy that one because it's one of my favorites.
Yeah, I bought the Ken Liu one. I was at a bookstore. I gave it to Impulse.
Nice. So, yeah, I think it's nice to support authors in the literary world for sure. So once in a while, it's a good thing.
Yeah, it's funny. I've got some favorite authors I feel like I should just send some money to because I've either bought them used or gotten them at the library or, you know, otherwise gotten things in the way that they don't get any money out of it. Well, we're looking for your fall reading suggestions right now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You know, so post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
And let's take a caller now. We've got Tony here in Rhinelander. Tony, hi.
Hi, Rob and Veronica. How are you?
Not bad. How about you?
Good, good, good. I want to thank Rob for making a recommendation of Patrick Rothfuss.
Yes.
I read both of the books that he had out just within the last 2 months, and I just sucked right in.
And Veronica's a fan, too, I should say.
Right, and I told you about them, and actually.
We got a level with you, Tony. I will be honest. Veronica's the one who recommended those to me. And now you've joined our club, waiting for part three to come out.
Tell him to hurry up.
You know, I don't want to pressure him, but with the third book. Yeah, they're so good, though.
And it's a Wisconsin author, too, which is great.
I very much enjoyed them, so thank you both for helping me along to that that particular realm.
Absolutely. Are you reading anything else, Tony, that you're excited about?
I've got about a zillion things, but nothing in particular right now. I'm in between books, shall we say.
Oh, okay.
That's a bad place to be. When I'm in between books, I get a little listless.
Well, you know, as soon as I make one that I can read while I'm mowing the lawn, that'll be fantastic.
I was going to say audiobooks, man. Lawn mowing, yeah, that's a tall order because you got to be able to hear the book. Tony, thanks a lot. Happy reading to you. Tony, thanks a lot for calling. We're taking your reading suggestions for the fall at 800-642-1234. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Again, 800-642-1234. Do you have a place to go, Veronica, where you look for book suggestions?
Well, I like the Publisher's Weekly website. I look for the latest news there, and I look at the New York Times book reviews. That's important. I get a lot of stuff on Twitter. I ask you quite a lot, what are you reading? We have some overlap. You like things a little bleaker than I do, and I like young adult literature more than you do, but we have some overlap.
Yeah, definitely. We definitely can share ideas back and forth. YA, I should. I mean, that's a lot of untapped potential for me, the YA fiction.
And you didn't read Harry Potter.
I read the first one.
Yeah, it's not reading Harry Potter. There are 7 books?
Don't Potter shame me.
I'm Potter shaming you.
Let's take another caller now. Gil is on the line in Madison. Gil, hi.
Hey, yeah, I actually haven't started reading this yet, but I'm looking forward to it. In fact, the author was just in town, and I didn't get to go hear him speak. It is called Dinner at the Center of the Earth by Nathan Englander.
Yeah, he's a great writer.
It's about a secret prisoner who's been held in a black site in the Negev Desert for a dozen years, suspended with his guard in a state of mutually shattering existential limbo.
Wow.
That's from the book jacket, I take it?
No, Gil just came.
He
just winged that?
Yes,
okay.
Yes.
That sounds good. I've read his short stories, and they were really excellent. They're really well written, and I did not know he had a new book out. That's great to hear about.
Yeah, and he just spoke at the public library, I think, last night or the night before about the book in Madison here, and I missed it.
And he was a Wisconsin author. I'm not sure whether he still is or not. But
yeah, I'm not sure either.
He has some ties, though. He has some ties. So, yeah, that's a great one. Dinner at the Center of the Earth from Nathan Englander. Short story lovers. Do you like short stories, Rob?
I don't read enough of them lately, actually. I used to be more into them. It's been a while. But you know what? So a lot of the time I'm looking for some big honking book or trilogy that, like, once I know I like it, I know I'm in for, like, hundreds of pages of good reading.
Me
but short stories can be good. And we're taking your calls for recommended reading this time of year as things cool off at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
All right, we'll go to another caller. We've got Donovan in Appleton. Donovan, hi.
How you doing?
Good. What do you got for us?
It's a book series called Lutsum and the Dragon Mage Wars. It's kind of a Lord of the Rings type series. The great thing about it, the author came, there's like five books in the series as of right now. He's writing the sixth as we speak. But the great thing was that the author came up with the entire story and was releasing the books like 1 month after another.
Oh, wow.
So you don't have that long, year wait before the next book comes out.
That is a great thing. So this is adult fiction, right? This is
exactly, yeah. So more of a sci-fi fantasy, like I said, kind of Lord of the Rings.
That sounds pretty good. All right. Well, thank you for that suggestion, Donovan. Appreciate you calling in. And we have with us now Daniel Golden, the owner of Boswell Book Company on Downer Avenue, Milwaukee. Daniel, thanks so much for joining us.
Appreciate it. Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having us.
Well, tell us a little bit about what you're excited about this fall.
I was just going to comment on, I was able to go in and hear a little bit of stuff. And so if I feel like there's a speculative element to it, I will make that alert for Rob. And also, so I have the answer for you about Englander. His girlfriend at the time was going to grad school in Madison.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how he wound up there. He's back in New York now.
Okay, we lost him.
Yeah, we lost him. No, he came back because he loves you.
true.
And speaking of speculative, I might have missed. Did you guys talk about Kazuo Ishiguro?
We didn't yet. I was waiting for you to talk about that.
He won the Nobel Prize.
That was quite a big win.
It doesn't seem like that out of a box pick for me, but apparently it was because first of all. He is, even though he is Japanese by birth, he's lived in Great Britain since he was five, he was writing in English, so there were two non-translated authors in a row, and so he was actually very, also he's popular, and they thought, well, following a Bob Dylan, they would probably pick a more obscure writer. I guess I can't pronounce his name exactly well, so I apologize to everyone who knows who's Kenyan, but the favorite was actually a gentleman named Ngugi wa Thiong'o. Ladbroke in Great Britain runs odds on who's going to win the Booker Prize every year, and he did not have great numbers. But Ishiguro is probably most famous for three of his books, two of which became films, The Remains of the Day, which is the story of this butler and the decline of sort of the class system in Great Britain, a little oblivious to his surroundings, probably misremembering parts of his life, and Never Let Me Go, which is about three people at a boarding school who turn out to be clones. Who are being grown to so some people can harvest their organs. The thing that seems to be so that's a good speculative book, definitely sort of a dystopian. But all his books, he never writes the same book twice, which is why one of those things about great literary writers, at least on the outside, but in the inside, his themes repeat a lot. And definitely things about memory and how it is distorted by time and our inability to face the past, as people have said. So, he's a great, I think those two books are where people would start. His most recent book is The Buried Giant.
I want to read that one.
Yeah. Also, I think fantasy fans might enjoy it. It's actually set in Arthurian, post-Arthurian Britain. So
some good reading lists there if you want to catch up on Kazuo Ishiguro. And I've got some phone calls for you now. Daniel, let's go to Jared in McFarland first. Jared, hi.
Hi, hello there.
Hey.
What are you thinking about?
With the PBS special, the Vietnam War on recently, got me to thinking about my dad's friend, Stephen Menendez. He was a tunnel rat in Vietnam. And he has two books out. One is called A Journey into the Darkness, and the other one is called Battle at Straight Edge Woods. And if you ever wanted to know what a shoulder was feeling, what it was like to be there, his accounts are amazing.
Thank you.
It really puts you there. I mean, if you wanted to know anything about that, his books are something else to read. Stephen Menendez.
Jared, thank you so much for calling with that. Does that bring anything else to mind? Any new books about war and that experience firsthand, Daniel?
Well, whenever there's sort of a major event like the Vietnam series, booksellers always get to thinking about other books that people might be interested in. We have a nice little display about the miniseries. And there, I would say that probably the most recent book is Mark Bowden's book, Way 68, which is a nonfiction book. There's also, of course, reaching back to a lot of other wonderful novels and story collections like Carl Marlantis's Matterhorn, Robert Owen Butler's Good Son from a Strange Mountain, and of Tim O'Brien's Things They Carried, which is probably the king of Vietnam War fiction. Who just passed away, Dennis Johnson, his book Tree of Smoke, which won the National Book Award. They're all, even more recently, The Sympathizer, which won every award, I believe, by a Viet Thanh Nguyen. That's a perspective looking at the Vietnam War and aftermath from the perspective of Vietnamese. So they're all great things to follow up, and maybe this gentleman or anyone else who's really enjoyed the miniseries would like them.
Jared, thanks a lot for that call. And Daniel Golden stays with us now. He's the owner of Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee, and we're here to talk about fall reading season.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are you reading now? What is top of your reading list? Or do you need a suggestion from Daniel? Call 800-642-1234.
And we'll pick up our conversation in just a little bit. Stay with us on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And right now we're picking up our conversation about books to look forward to this reading season with Daniel Golden. He's with us and the owner of Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What have you just read? What are you about to read? Or do you need a suggestion? Call 800-642-1234.
And Daniel, we were talking a little bit over email about some new favorites or books that so you were thinking about books that kind of play on the classics. What do you have in that vein?
We have several new books, one of which has Wisconsin ties too. One book that came out in August that a whole bunch of us really loved is called The World Broken Two. Bill Goldstein is a book critic. He worked at the New York Times Books website, Publishers Weekly, which I've heard you've read over the years. He was the books editor for a long time. Mm-hmm. I'm like the book news editor. And he's written this really great book about Virginia Woolf, D.H. Lawrence, T.S. Eliot, and E.M. Forster, all in one year, 1922, all three of whom were creating some of their most famous works, and one of whom, D.H. Lawrence, had a book called Kangaroo, which was not that popular, but one of his other famous books, Women in Love, exploded in sales because it was banned. What they were doing was they're all reacting to, they're all in these crises, like E.M. Forster was writing Passage to India, and they were in crisis because they had all read Ulysses, and Ulysses had basically ushered in the age of modernism.
He blew everything up.
It blew everything up, and it really affected all their writing. What I love about this book, it's a group biography. It really makes all these writers accessible. What I love about these kind of books is even if you haven't read the book, and especially if you haven't read the book, you want to read one of these books. It shows how the creative process is not always easy. We think of Virginia Woolf as being, you know, this genius of language, and she was struggling, just like all these writers were. I was very excited about that. It tied into another book that is just out in paperback called Books for a Living by Will Schwalbe. He had a very successful book called The End of Your Life Book Club about reading books with his mom, and this is sort of a follow-up. The one thing that I didn't love about the book is that you would hear about all these amazing books, both classic and contemporary, but there wasn't really that much about each one. So this is 26, I think, chapters, and each one focuses on a different book. They're not his favorite books. They're the books that influence his life. Once again, you read the book, and you can't not pick up a book that he recommended. I wound up finally reading Rebecca by Stephanie Demarié, the mother of all psychological suspense. And he put it in such interesting perspective. I'm kind of excited. He's not going to be around Milwaukee, but he's actually at the Fox Cities Book Festival on the 12th. I just happened as I was doing my things. He's doing two talks there.
Right, and this is Will Schwalbe, and the book is called Books for Living.
Yeah. One last one I wanted to mention is coming out very soon, and I love, love, love it. It's called Montaigne in Barn Boots. It's the new book of new nonfiction book from Michael Perry,
Wisconsin author.
Yeah, I mean,
and
uber Wisconsin author. And And I just actually finished reading Population 485 because it was in Jim Hicken's book, Wisconsin Literary Luminaries. And I'd read a number of his other books, but I never read the first one. So I wound up reading that. And after reading this Montaigne and Barn Boots, it really tied it all together because he does the same thing. In Montaigne and Barn Boots, he reads this classic philosopher, Montaigne, who's enjoying this wonderful resurgence. There's a book about Montaigne like every 3 years. He's so timely in some ways in what he writes about. And then Perry spins it off into his own world, filled with the humor that everybody loves. But I think he really takes it to another level. I think some people are going to be surprised at some of the things that Perry talks about in terms of intellectual rigor, and also, but it always in his modest and wonderful way. People are also talking about Montaigne because by far the most hand-sold book of 2017 is A Gentleman in Moscow by Amor Towles, and it's about a man after the Russian Revolution who's imprisoned in a hotel, and he reads Montaigne for sustenance, and that's what the book is about: persevering and the fragility of life and overcoming obstacles and people. They're great books to read together, and it made me definitely buy one of the books of Montaigne's essays.
Those sound great.
It's 800 pages. So
800 pages. Wow. That's a commitment. So that was Montaigne and Barn Boots by Michael Perry and A Gentleman in Moscow. So a couple there. Let's take another caller now. We've got Jim with us in Harvard, Illinois. Jim, hello.
Hi. Actually, the book I called about, before I say that, your guest mentioned Morante's Matterhorn. He also wrote a book.
Oops, I missed you there. I think your phone crackled on us. What was it?
Morante's also wrote a book called What It's Like to Be in Combat, that's even more gripping, I think, than Matterhorn. I read them both. But the book I called to recommend was Stamped from Beginning, The History of Racism in America, which I think won a National Book Award. And it's amazing. He traces slavery back to Portugal in the 1400s, and the word slave comes from Slav, and actually Middle East, Eastern Europeans, whites were made into slaves back in those days as well.
That was Stamped from the Beginning. Jim, thank you for that call. Does that bring anything to mind?
Well, yes, Annette. That book is selling very well. It just came out in paperback. Well, it brings to mind the National Book Awards because they announced the long list, and now the short list is out. They're going to announced the winners on November 14th, and once again, it's a very fine collection of books. I would say that the National Book Awards, even more than some others, there's some issue. They tend to be very issue-driven in the nonfiction. The one that's probably closest to Stamped from the Beginning is Erica Armstrong Dunbar's history called Never Caught, the Washington's Relentless Pursuit of Their Runaway Slave by Ona Judge, who teaches at Rutgers. Another book that I think the author, like, really readable, wonderful book is New Yorker writer David Grand's Killers of the Flower Moon, The Osage Murders, and The Birth of the FBI. And that is about systematic murder of Native Americans in the 1920s for the land that they owned that suddenly became oil rich or discovered it was oil rich. That's definitely probably the one that I might recommend from that. But there's some it's a nice selection of books for our caller.
And the National Book Award is announced November 14th. Is that correct?
Right. We're right in the midst of award season. I would say it's kicked off by the Nobel Prize, and I think it's just a week until they announce the Man Booker Prize. This is the third year where they're having Americans compete, and once again, there are several Americans in the running, including she's not a Wisconsinite, but she's a Minnesotan, and they definitely get the broadcast because I've heard people in Twin Cities tell me they listen to Wisconsin Public Radio. History of Wolves by Emily Fridlin is the first novel. Really great book that I enjoyed about a young girl in the Minnesota woods who has to struggle with several things in her life, a teacher accused of inappropriate sexual behavior that she becomes obsessed with, and then she's a babysitter for a neighboring family who have their own secret. So that's really exciting.
And we have to leave it there. I'm sorry, we're out of time. Daniel, thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
That was Daniel Golden, the owner of Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee. And we've been talking and getting suggestions about what to read now that the weather's colder and it is pretty much the ideal season to read.
There was a non-sports controversy on the football field during last night's game between Minnesota and Chicago. No, not that controversy.
After scoring a touchdown, a few of the Vikings sat in a circle for a quick round of duck, duck, goose as their touchdown celebration.
And that is where the controversy kicks in. A Minnesota wide receiver who's actually from Minnesota said the game is called Duck, Duck, Gray Duck.
What? Yeah, and this kicked off a lot of internet response. It looks like it's Minnesota versus pretty much the world. Minnesotans go with Duck, Duck, Gray Duck, and everybody else seems to go with Duck, Duck, Goose.
Wait a minute. Fact, it is Duck, Duck, Gray Duck, Breanne Shasso. Just to, are you from Minnesota, Breanne?
She
is.
She
okay,
is.
So
yeah.
I guess if somebody orders a brandy old fashioned from you, you know they're from Wisconsin. Somebody invites you to a game of duck, duck, gray duck. Doesn't come up often. They're from Minnesota. So we want to hear from you on this. Tweet us if you have, in fact, now or ever have played duck, duck, gray duck. I'm going to stick with goose.
Well, and I've told you this story, but my husband's family likes to say rabbit, rabbit, white rabbit on the first day of the month. And they're near Minnesota, near the Minnesota border up by Eau Claire.
It's a strange culture in those parts, I guess, is what we're learning here. Well, again, share your version of Duck, Duck, Goose. Tweet us at Central Time WPR or message us on the Ideas Network Facebook page. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.